Hello, and welcome to the Time Wars Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast.
My name is John Mayo.
In this episode, we'll be having a spoiler-filled discussion about one of the Time Wars novels by Simon Hawke.
In this episode, I am joined by my sister, and we're going to have a spoiler-filled discussion on the Six-Gun Solution, which is the 12th and currently final book of the Time War series. I'm holding out hope for more books. It's been 25-plus years, so it's I don't know if we're likely to get them or not.
Hope springs eternal.
I'm hoping we're getting to the point where the author, Simon Hawke, is kind of hit retirement age and doesn't have to do the day job and can actually spend time writing.
Would be nice.
On his page on Goodreads from a few years back when he was going through and getting the books back out and stuff into print and whatnot, he implied that he saw more story potential in the premise and seemed to have ideas for stuff. So I'm hopeful.
Yeah, it's a rich universe.
Oh yeah, and I can think of a couple of different things that could be done. We've talked about a few. I had one or two more thoughts when we went through this. And 12 books in, number of things in play that I felt this kind of had to touch on and resolve to varying degrees. And for the most part, I felt it did. There was one or two that weren't addressed, that were not in the obligatory to address, but I was expecting nonetheless. Mm. But overall, I thought this was a satisfying conclusion to the series. And yet again, it was we've talked about a couple of points in the series of books where there's a definite formulaic aspect. Other times it veers from formula. And a few times where it's like these books are now different than the previous ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt certainly with the Hellfire Rebellion and the Cleopatra Crisis, we're getting into the politics and the main movers and shakers of the time. Six-Gun Solution, unsurprisingly, set in the Western, in Tombstone, Arizona, around the time of the OK, shootout at the OK Corral.
Which wasn't at the OK Corral. And they made sure we knew that.
A few times.
Yes.
But this is one where in the prologue, we get Scott Nielsen.
Yes.
Who's been in The Dracula Caper, and I think we saw again in Hellfire Rebellion.
Yeah.
Maybe one or two other times. Just as a callback kind of a...
I think he showed up briefly in a Cleopatra Crisis when they had to call more people in.
Yeah, he did. So he wasn't on the mission, but he was involved with it. And he's front and center in the prologue. And at first I'm thinking, gosh, I hope he survives the prologue.
Yes.
Because in so many books, the guy who's there at the beginning doesn't.
Well, but the good news is that he was spending the prologue trying to find out what had happened to three observers who had died.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't see the people who died in the prologue. We just kind of skipped the pre-prologue where they died and went to investigate their death.
So the requirement of dead people in the prologue was fulfilled, is your mantra?
Yeah, because it just happened off screen.
I'd have to go back through the 12 prologues and count up how many of them have somebody who doesn't survive.
It felt like quite a few.
I think you could almost go back all the way to the beginning, because while the first prologue of the Ivanhoe Gambit features Lucas, he talks to Jesse or Jenny.
Yeah, Jessie, the girl.
And she's in the dead zone or whatever.
Yeah.
Before the end of the prologue.
Yeah. Well, and Scott Nielsen is investigating the three observers from Outpost G-6898. That tells you how many observers we have throughout history, that we now have these identifiers on the outposts.
It's funny because that identifier is almost reminiscent of like the Stargate, you know, planet or whatever. And of course, those things from the TV show. TV show was many years later.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does give a sense of size and scope of it.
Mm-hmm.
Almost most of the story, not all of it, is in 1881. We spend a little bit of time, plus time in the 27th century, a little somewhere in like maybe the 23rd century or whatever, ever so briefly. And I was starting to wonder the specific years of a few of the other books, because it feels like the 1800s we've spent a fair amount of time in. Because I was trying to place Dracula Caper, Lilliput Legion, and a few of the others.
Yeah, they were about that time frame. I mean, obviously, Hellfire was, you know, 1770s. I'm trying to think, the Three Musketeers and Scarlet Pimpernel. They were about 100 years before, I guess. One was 100 years before, one was the 1800s.
Yeah, the Timekeeper conspiracy was in the 17th century. I'd have to place. I don't think they ever got to where they were overlapping.
No.
But there was certain hot spots in time.
Yeah.
Which I found interesting and just, again, kind of curious as to, you've got all of time and whatnot to play with. There are certain periods that have richer story potential than others.
Yeah.
You know, I think World War II would be an interesting place. And almost given the scale of the war, you've got to figure there are a lot of time soldiers there. When you then get to the point where you have to have observers, mm-hmm. how does that play out?
Yeah.
So we had, again, as you mentioned, he was there to investigate the observers who died. This is yet another one that kind of starts out with instead of a report of something that went wrong, it starts out actually with a lack of a report of something going wrong.
Yeah.
They've gone quiet, let's go investigate, which I thought was an interesting variation on the theme.
Yeah.
Because you go back to like the Lilliput Legion and a few others, you know, you've got firsthand accounts of this isn't right, we've got to do something. Even the Argonaut affair started with the finding of the centaur.
Yeah.
You know, by the time we get to the story that the centaur is there, but again, you've had to find him to bring him plus time to study him.
Well, and we've had lots of comments about how dangerous an observer's life is.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not quite payoff, but this is kind of following through on, see, we told you, they don't all survive.
Well, and at one point, when we see the quarters in which they were living, it's like, yeah, this is not the glamorous life.
Yeah.
But we've got Nielsen here, who was I would say, kind of a featured guest star in the Dracula Caper,
mm-hmm.
a cameo in one or two others. But in this book, he really comes front and center.
Yeah.
I would say for at least half the book is the lead character.
Yes.
And it did make me wonder if there were more books to come after this. I mean, he seems like one that would be obligated to come back.
Oh,
potentially
definitely.
Leading an adjustment team.
Yeah.
We do get mention of Nikolai Drakov in the prologue. And I'm like, well, geez, he's mentioned. He's gonna appear. We get mention of his genetic engineering skills and stuff. And I'm like, oh, we're gonna have some hominoids. Again, both were expected. You've got to kind of cleanly wrap that up. We also got a couple of things that I thought were interesting. Nielsen gets aged 25, mm-hmm. was his age, and it mentions later he looks like 17 or something. I'm like, I'm not sure I realized in the other books he was quite so young.
Well, but they said, part of what they said there was it wasn't just that he looked young. For the Old West, he looked 17 because with the anti-aging drugs, he couldn't grow a beard. And in the Old West, if you had no facial hair, you must be a teenager.
No, I caught that part. I guess I'm saying back in the Dracula Caper, mm-hmm. when he was the assistant at the morgue or whatever, I knew he was young-ish. He was a bit of a green recruit or whatever.
Yeah, and see, I thought they were all 21, 22 because of that. Fresh out of college, cannon fodder is how they came across there.
He felt like Lucas had been recruited later in life because he'd already had a corporate job.
Definitely.
So I hadn't assumed Nielsen was quite as young. And the fact that he looks so young.
Yeah, I mean, see that.
At this point, he's the same age as Andre was a couple of books back.
Yeah.
As to how much time elapsed between books, hard to tell. In one or two cases, it's overnight. In other cases, a few missions have happened.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course, plus time, a few missions happening could be an hour. There was also a couple of references I thought were kind of cool here. There was one to the Mask of Zorro, and I'm like, man, that's another story waiting to be told.
Yes, yes.
If you did another Western in this, the Lone Ranger, Zorro, other kind of fictional characters or whatever seemed to be. And again, if you had asked me at the beginning of this series how I would have expected a Western to go, I would have expected fictional Western characters.
Yeah.
Not kind of legendary folklore real characters.
Yeah.
And there comes a point where a historical figure goes from person to kind of that legend, myth, to fictional almost.
There is that, yeah.
Because the this is all dealing with the Earps, the Clantons, and Bat Masterson and all of that. And there comes a point where you've ceased talking about the real person and you've gone to a fictionalized version.
Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that the books were veering more and more in that venue, because definitely Cleopatra Crisis and Hellfire Rebellion are very much there. But even as recently as Lilliput and Dracula, you know,
with the authors.
Well, with the authors, with still fictional characters of the Lupusians, the
true,
the vampires and stuff like that. And while there may be historical basis for characters like Robin Hood as far back as the first book, we were really dealing with the more fictionalized version.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was interesting. I loved the comment about the original manuscript for 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Yeah, so did I.
You know, the original, not the edited one that saw print.
Yeah.
That was a nice reference to the Nautilus Sanction.
The one unknown to history that even came with an inscription to Moses Forrester.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was very nice.
Well, and it was good to have a callback to that book. And over the course of this novel, did you call backs to most of the novels, I think? Maybe not all of them, but it felt like a lot of them. And the Nautilus Sanction was a key turning point, because that's when Dracoff got introduced.
Yeah.
What I did appreciate is we got a fairly good description of Nielsen. And at this point, I'm thinking, he may survive this book.
Yeah.
At first, again, we start with him, and I'm like, geez, he's doomed. So I thought that was interesting. And then he does find some information out about these observers, about how they had been shot and whatnot, and must have been up close because there were burn marks on them, etc. And of course, the first thing that popped into my mind reading that description was a Mike Myers quote from Austin Powers: "Lasers."
Okay, fair enough.
You know what I mean?
Yes, yes.
Where he had to explain them in the future to people. Yeah, we know what those are.
Yeah, yeah.
So it definitely set the time and the place pretty quickly, and I think we were overdue, I think, for a Western.
Yeah, I can see why you're saying that. Yeah, it was a definite change of pace.
And it was nice to get something that was, while set in a particular time and place with historical importance or whatever, the Western is, it's a genre, the sword and sandals genre is pretty wide and encompassing.
Yeah.
But if you ask somebody, give me the basic plot of a Western.
Yes.
There are certain things you just check the boxes, and there are variations on the theme, there are different ways you can go. A multitude of stories you can tell there, but there's also a sense of familiarity.
When Nielsen was told, you know, you go back, you lay low, you casually ask questions, but you don't get involved in the scenario. And almost immediately, talking about one of those checkboxes, he overhears an argument where one gambler is accusing another of cheating, and weapons are drawn, and the bartender's pulling the second weapon after one of the cheaters has. And Nielsen has this choice, as there's a third gun drawn, and he's being told, you know, disarm the bartender, of, do I take the bartender's weapon and risk a historical figure being shot, or do I pull my gun and shoot?
Well, and this is one of those cases, you know, we've talked about how certain aspects of Lucas's history, like he's being an avid history buff, weren't referred to in other books. We know Nielsen is a firearms aficionado, is skilled with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, he proves it with a lightning fast quick draw or whatever.
Yeah.
And we even get a good explanation elsewhere in the book of how before getting to town, he'd bought the guns, took them outside of that town, got used to the sights, tested them.
Yeah.
To where he was comfortable with the weapons he'd gotten in the era.
Yeah.
And, but it was one of those things where that lengthy passage we got in the Dracula caper, where they were going over Reese's gun collection or whatever, prepping for something, and he was, oh, wow, look at this, look at that.
Oh, that was Hellfire, but yes.
Was it Hellfire? You're right, it was Hellfire.
Yeah.
That's right. I was thinking the Dracula one, because they keep, that's the mission they always reference him in.
It is. It is. And but, that was the one where we first saw him do some trick shooting.
Yeah. But he was in a fair amount of the Hellfire one, too. So to not really get credit for that seems a little odd.
Yeah.
But again, we've established him, his quick thinking nature, and his suitability for the Western.
Yes. Yes.
So, of course, I was happy to see him as early as the prologue.
Yeah.
If he'd gotten just a bare mention of, oh, it's too bad Nielsen's not here, I would have been bummed.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that makes him realize that the death of the observers is suspicious is not just the whole, the burn marks, but their warp disks are kind of hidden under, like, I guess a turquoise stone or something to look like Indian bracelets. Yeah. They're sentimental. And, you know, all the personal effects of the observers were sold off because there was no one who knew them. But no, those Indian bracelets, now that you mention it, they were nowhere to be found after they died.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, what are the odds that the only future tech they had with them, the only useful future tech, no less.
The disguised warp disks are the only thing that turn up missing.
Yeah.
So he was clear something suspicious was going on.
Yeah.
In chapter one, we get a Dracoff pretty early on.
Yeah. We almost had to.
Yeah. This is not a book to do a slow burn on him.
Yeah. Well, and, okay, just to slow down for a moment, because I went into this book figuring if it is the end of the series, we have to have Dracoff.
Yep.
But we kind of have to have something from the other time stream, don't we? Which kind of means the SOG.
Yeah, we've got to resolve the time war.
So the strategic operations group.
Yep.
And then within our own time stream, we're kind of crowded on agencies.
Because
we've got our commandos, we've got our rangers, we've got the former intelligence agency that's now part of our commandos, but they have their bad element, if you will, that's the network.
Yep.
And then we have the underground.
Yep.
So you could have, I guess that's four different types of people. Time travelers from our group.
You can easily have multiple agendas going on at play.
Yes. Yeah. And I kind of wondered if that's what we were going to hit here, because that was something we hadn't really hit. We'd feared and we'd alluded to in previous books, but we hadn't really had happen.
Well, and I figured we had to get a sense of resolution on most of those, maybe not all of those. And because there are a few other things that have been mentioned a number of times that even after this book, I don't feel we got. I don't really feel that we had any adjustment team go over to the other side and really monkey with their timeline.
Right. Well, but I think they feel we did in this book. As we go further, we'll get there, but I think they feel we did.
Maybe, but not to the point of Forrester calling the team and here is your mission.
True. True.
Go to this confluence point we found. Go do this. We don't think it'll cause a big adjustment, but we think it'll kind of warble their timeline a little.
But that's kind of been the problem with this whole war between the time streams. Every time we've, quote, attacked the other time stream, we haven't known we did it. It was an accident.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you put it that way, because there's an aspect where they could encounter the SOG. It's that we've got a warp grenade. I'm going to blow up that little, you know, shelf over there, this little tiny area. But on the other side, the less I use here, the more goes over there.
Yes.
There's a bizarre, almost Mexican standoff you could do with that.
That's a good point.
That it's like, well, you don't know what I'm going to hit. Neither do you.
Yes, you're right.
The fact that was, I would not expect Lucas to do that.
No.
Or Finn or Andre. But that again, seems like a rogue element.
Yeah.
A network person might have done it.
Yeah.
Shocking we never saw that. Probably good. That's kind of a mean thing to do.
Pretty much. Okay, so we got Dracoff, and we realized he has Saloon Girl in play.
Yep. I'm like, okay, we've gotten Dracoff. We've gotten the Hominoid. That was pretty quick. We got a lot to cover. We got to fit him in the book soon.
Oh, and hey, look, in his drawer, he happens to have three matching Indian bracelets.
Now, at one point, and I'm just kind of going through my notes, so I may get these a little out of things. There's a comment Dracoff makes I will not underestimate them this time.
Mm.
Like, really? Sure you won't. You do it every time.
I know.
But there comes a point your grand plan ought to be zap, you're dead.
But isn't that like a standard bad guy line?
It is.
I mean, don't get me wrong. If delivered well, it makes sense. It's a good line. But it's kind of the bad guy assumes I've got my plan figured out. The bad guy has to have a certain amount of ego or he can't be a good bad guy.
No, and I get that. But one of the other things I would have liked to have gotten as kind of a story in between these is one where almost, you know, maybe a rookie adjustment team, but an adjustment team is having to deal with Drakov. But there's this other party involved.
Yeah.
Which turns out to be another Drakov.
Yes.
And that for whatever reasons, they wind up in the same place on kind of counterbalancing sides. And this adjustment team is almost getting credit for having defeated one or both.
Yes. Yeah.
And all they're doing is surviving.
Yeah, pretty much.
But again, didn't get that.
Well, Drakov tips us off a little bit to what this book is going to be about.
Oh, yeah. The Imagine, the Network, the SOG, the Temporal Underground, and the TIA all gathered in one place at one strategic time. And I'm like, yeah, somehow I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Now, why Tombstone? Why now? Was still a little puzzling.
Oh, exactly. But he had basically realized that the best way for him to defeat everybody was to bait everybody into fighting each other.
Mm-hmm.
Without him having to be involved.
And it's a solid plan.
It is. Now, the only thing that he had felt he needed to do, and Scott goes out to see where the observers lived, mm-hmm. and confirms it, by finding tiny holes in the adobe wall,
mm-hmm.
where they, you know, they'd been burned by the lasers. Right. So all Drakov had to do was kill the observers.
Well, it's interesting because Bat Masterson is the one who takes Nielsen mm-hmm. out. That's the guy who Nielsen had saved. And they're doing a lot of talking back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it really says something about the nature of the writing, where I think it lends itself to moving to movie and TV. A lot of it is so-and-so said a lot of stuff so-and-so said. Not a lot of while Masterson saying this and Nielsen was looking around the room.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you get to the Nielsen, that wasn't what he was looking for. He found this. Your mind just kind of fills in. Well, while they were talking, he was looking around. I could see how they would shoot this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
There are aspects of this that are written as if a screenplay in the style of a novel.
Yes.
But there are other ones, and I highlighted one or two of them later on, where it's like, you need this. It's good. It rolls out well in the book. But how would you shoot that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because there are certain things you can do in novels that, again, you're almost killing time with a conversation so somebody can look around a place,
mm-hmm.
that flow to a screen. There are other times where it's, I need you, the audience, to know this.
Yeah.
That's real easy to do in a book, but really hard to do on screen.
Well, this was a great conversation between Bat Masterson and Scott, because he's saying, look, you just got yourself a reputation
mm-hmm.
for being a gunfighter.
The Montana Kid.
Yeah, yeah. And he's like, you killed two men, shot them through the heart without seeming to aim. And he said, you know, I'm asking you, how are you doing? And you're saying, implying at least, this isn't the first time I've killed people. Well, people say I've killed 30 people. I've only killed one.
Mm-hmm.
But because I say, well, you know, it depends. I don't count Indians and Mexicans. I give vague answers because I'm willing to let the reputation grow. And
well, it's almost healthier to let it grow in some respects.
And he talks about what the reputation does for you in terms of you can stare people down, because with that reputation, they don't want to pull a gun on you. But you also have the flip side of people like the Earps don't want you in their town because you have that reputation.
It's funny because there's an almost Hitchcockian aspect to that mindset of let the audience fill in the blanks.
Yeah, yeah.
That, you know, if you show the bomb under the table, you've got to explode the bomb under the table kind of a deal for Hitchcock. And in the West, it's if you pull the gun, you've got to shoot the gun almost. And you're better off not getting to that point. And if you've got a reputation where it's a, do you want to try your luck with me, kid?
Yes, yes.
That can be enough.
Yeah.
It's almost Batman aspect, you know, the scare the criminals kind of mentality.
Yeah.
Yeah, there were a couple of places where I thought Bat Masterson and one or two of the Earps or whatever were used really well as characters and whatnot, both not just to move the story along, but again, the way they interacted with Nielsen and stuff.
Yeah.
Because at this point, again, Nielsen, as far as I'm concerned, was the lead character. It's not until, I think, Chapter 2 that we really start seeing Finn, Lucas, and Andre.
Well, Nielsen comes back to report in.
Yeah.
And that's when they get brought in. And he feels better reporting into Forrester because Lucas and Finn and Andre are there. And he's served with them. So reporting in directly to the old man, the top guy.
Yeah, that'd be intimidating. He's the authority figure. He's the guy in charge. You've worked with the other ones.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, when we got the description of Delaney this time, what I had noticed was dark red hair and was uncombed. Full beard gave him an aspect of a drunken Irish poet. Full beard.
Yeah.
He was clean shaven in the Cleopatra crisis.
Yeah. I don't think he was happy about it.
Oh, no. Yes. Well, I don't think he was happy about the black hair either.
Yes.
But it goes back to some amount of time has elapsed.
True, true.
Could just be a couple of weeks, but to grow the beard back out and whatnot.
Yeah.
But it was nice to get the reference again to the time Nielsen had spent with them in Victoria in London where half the team died.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, that was another kind of brutal one for the assistants.
Yeah.
But I go back to, I think they brought it on themselves. They'd had one cover identity, not two. I don't think Inspector Grayson would have tipped to them.
Yeah, that's true.
There was mention of the Khyber Pass, which was in 1897. So that's, 16 years from when this is set.
Yes.
And we get a couple of other subtle things here. Forrest not referring to Dracoff as his son, giving again an aspect of, okay, let's do a little, side story on what his background is. I think we get that a little later.
Mm-hmm.
But they do this over drinks, and they did this specifically over glasses of single malt Scotch whiskey. Oh, this is after they've broken and are discussing their plans or whatever with just Finn, Delaney, and
right. They've decided
Lucas and Andre
that Scott can go back, but Andre is expressed
get a full night's sleep and then go back.
Yeah, but she's expressed concerns of. He's the Montana kid. There's no Montana kid in the scenario. Anybody who's learned about Wyatt Earp.
We're using this kid as bait.
Yeah, and she has real misgivings about that. And Finn and Lucas aren't thrilled about it, but they're pointing out, look, if he's already drawn the spotlight, that means the three of us can work in the background.
But then they decide to go using their real names with no cosmetic surgery. And then when they later, it's like, I think our cover's been blown. You knew that was part of your plan.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, they did that figuring that meant that people from their time and their timeline would be drawn to them.
I think they had to realize even the special operations group. This is the frontline team.
Yeah.
But I did want to go back to that drink bit for a second.
Okay.
They're all drinking single malt Scotch whiskey.
Okay.
I thought in previous books, each had their own drink. And in one of the books, Finn was playing, bartender, whatever. He got so-and-so for this, so-and-so for that, and he had this.
I thought Forrester was the only one who had the different drink. The red eye or whatever.
I know
we'd
he
have
had,
to go back and look.
I thought in one of them recently, when they were having the briefing.
That's interesting.
That Finn poured something different for each.
That's interesting.
It's not a big deal.
No, but yeah.
But it's sometimes the devil's in the details.
Yeah. Well, and if you're at the part I think you're at, this is the part where they accidentally, purposely...
Well, yeah, because they're like, okay, who's going in with who? We don't want to all go in at once, but Andre doesn't want to be a saloon girl for some reason.
Yes.
And then it's, okay, said Lucas with a grin. Lieutenant Cross, will you do me the honor of becoming my wife? And I'm like, that entire subplot was not in the last book at all when they were posing as husband and wife.
I know.
Yet it was a big deal in the previous book.
I know.
I mean, this goes back to discussions we've had about certain TV shows where it's like only one guy in the writer's room seems to know about this character.
Yes.
Or he's getting kickbacks from the actor to get on screen or something, you know?
Yeah.
This was a subplot that, you know, were some of the books out of order or not? I doubt it. I don't know. But this is a subplot that was completely dropped from one book and then popped back.
Yeah. But it was a hilarious conversation.
Oh, absolutely. And it would have played much better after Finn had been figured out, Lucas.
Yeah.
You know, and not had a mission or two go by.
Yeah. Well, and I love Finn makes some comment along the lines of, as an officer and a gentleman,
mm-hmm.
and suddenly a voice behind him says, as an officer, you leave rather a great deal to be desired. And if you're a gentleman, then I'm the queen of the Bloody May, and its darkness has appeared.
Yeah. We also, I think, around this time get the term confluence phenomenon.
Mm.
Which, I mean, we'd had confluence points or whatever, but there are a couple of places where the term suddenly gets capitalized, it gets important. It's as if it's a regular part of the vocabulary.
Yeah.
And there's I don't want to call it technobabble, but there is jargon.
Yes. Yeah.
That they use, one of which gets introduced in the course of this novel, almost in passing, in kind of build some momentum behind it, which I thought was interesting. And of course, when darkness shows up, they're like, we're gonna die.
Yes. Yeah.
You mentioned something last time about a key mission. This is it.
Yeah. Well, and darkness finally reveals something. He still won't answer a lot of questions, but he does reveal something important, which is that back in the Kyber Connection, that was not a sniper. That was not a Ghazi.
Yeah. He doesn't say who it was, I think, anywhere in the book.
No.
But it's as if somebody, arguably, potentially even from Darkness's time,
yeah,
had gone back to take Lucas out at a moment of opportunity.
Yeah.
Because that was crippling that side, potentially.
Yeah.
I mean, we never get a...
For all we know, it was Dracov.
Well, I would almost guarantee it was Dracov in so much as this gets revealed near the end of the book, but Darkness's main mission seemed to be to stop this particular plot of Dracov's.
Yes.
Which is a little ironic, given that Dracov's plot would have also eliminated this plot of Dracov's, but therein lies the rub.
Yeah.
It's not that you want to destroy somebody, you want to do it tactically, not catastrophically. When we get into chapter 3, once again, Nielsen's clocked back to Tombstone and is waiting for the team to show up because they're still figuring out their plan. We also get, Jenny using a chronoplate to go to 23rd century London to meet with Dracov. And it's interesting because it shows almost a subtle difference between the warp disk and the chronoplate. Because the chronoplate seems to be almost permanently set up in this one location and kind of sort of acting like an elevator, if you will, to another spot.
Yeah.
So you can have somebody use it and not know or understand the technology, whereas you really can't do that with a warp disk.
Yeah.
And I was almost wondering at one point, was there any way that you could kind of date where Dracov was in his timeline based on which technology you used? And it's like, no, you couldn't. There's one other thing I want to mention when we get to chapter 4.
Well, in chapter 3, Scott recalls the first time he tried going home on vacation after he had joined. And it was just, you know, not much time had passed for his family, but months, if not years, had passed for him. Yeah.
He was 4 years older, and for them, it'd been a couple of weeks.
Yeah. And it was just a really interesting section about how, you know, he may still be his mom's little boy in mom's eyes, but he's been to war for 4 years and he just couldn't relate to his parents, his girlfriend,
yeah,
etc. And he stopped going home. But it was also, he grew up in Tucson, and we had gotten quite a bit by this point about just what an Old West buff he was because it was a passion of his father's, etc.
It was an interesting, background for the character, and it played well. It made sense. It explained parts of what we had seen before, and, you know, arguably it was, I don't want to say retcon, but it was filling out the backstory, but not in any way that deviated or was surprising.
Well, it goes into my saying, you know, we find out about these characters what we need to know when we need to know it. We don't get to know them and later it's, oh wow, I'm so glad I already knew this.
Yeah, but I think that's an aspect of storytelling just in general. Because if you were to tell us, this guy is also an avid bowler, it'd be like, well, then bowling's going to come up in the story, isn't it? Or why are you telling me? You know what I mean?
Well, but I guess my point is there are some shows you watch on TV, for instance, mm-hmm. and the character, whether or not you see them, they have a wife that calls their desk periodically, mm-hmm. asks them to bring something home for the kids, etc., etc. And it may be a season or two seasons later that there's an episode where their kid's been in an accident and their kid becomes a part of the episode or something. But it's not a, hey, wow, I never knew they had a kid until the kid was in an accident.
Well, it's like if you end a murder mystery with the butler did it and you're like, wait, there's a butler?
Yeah.
That doesn't play. But they're also kind of the other end of the extreme where there have been some shows that have characters that are never on screen.
Joni Piccolo.
That's the exact one I was going to go with Happy Days.
Yeah.
You know, Joni's friend or whatever is on there for seasons before getting cast.
Yeah.
And, you know, how do you add those bits of bins around a character to flesh them out, to make their lives feel more real? But how do you do it in a way that you're not throwing in either clear red herrings or minutia that just gets in the way?
Yeah.
Because there's a certain amount of, if you establish this guy is you know, really knowledgeable about guns, he's a really good, you know, sharpshooter or whatever, and then you never use it, well, why did you waste the time in the story to tell us? Mm-hmm. You know, and I feel that's, you know, Lucas being a chess aficionado or whatever didn't matter until it did.
Yeah.
You know, him being into, you know, history or whatever didn't matter until it did. Mm-hmm. Now, could they have set that up? Could they have built that a little better? Yeah, I think they could have. Or they, Simon Hawke, the author. But it's also unreasonable to expect an author at the beginning of a novel that turns into a 12-book series.
Yeah.
To be able to project what he needs those characters to be over that course, mm-hmm. or if they'll even be around that entire time.
Yeah, yeah.
So the fact that we get some really good backstory on Nielsen, really, if you think about it, other than members of the adjustment team,
mm-hmm.
Finn, Lucas, Andre, Steiger, Moses, Forrester by extension, this is the only character other than a bad guy that we get the background of, the life story of.
Yeah.
Which to me was sort of promoting him into potential future lead character.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think you spend this much time on somebody without kind of repositioning them a little bit narratively.
Well, I think he was being brought into the fold. And I mean, when we get towards the end, we've repositioned a lot of people.
Yes. And we'll talk about some of that.
Yeah.
Then. Chapter four. So there's a line I want to mention because it actually had me look something up, which I think you'll hopefully find funny. This is when we're going on and on at the gun store about how all the guns are, and there's some with like a 9-inch barrel and huge or whatever, largest production handguns Colt had ever made, named in honor of Captain Samuel Hamilton Walker, the Texas Ranger, who had helped design them. I'm like, Walker, Texas Ranger?
Yes.
It was Cordell Walker.
Yes, it was.
And it was actually a little after this book was written that the show started.
That's funny.
Now, it may have been in pre-production or some such. It actually gets even funnier because it changed kind of hands pre-production, the Walker Texas Ranger, to the guy who would take it to the show or whatever. Because the guy who had originally been one of the guys involved with it went off to do his own little project, J. Michael Straczynski and Babylon 5.
Oh, that is funny.
So, this is a historical tidbit that no doubt was why they named Walker in the show. I just saw that and thought that was...
Yeah.
I had to go look. It's like, you know, when was this written versus when did the show come out?
Yeah.
And it was close, but it was not on the air when this was written.
Well, this is the chapter where we start trying to figure out if we've got some time anomalies.
Well, and we start to get a lot of other players like the Tim O'Fallon.
Yes.
And yeah. I'll be honest, when I first saw him, I'm like, is this Creed Steiger?
Mm. No, I was pretty sure he was Network.
It became clear he was Network, but mm-hmm. at first I was wondering, is Creed kind of situated himself here without the team knowing?
Yeah.
And doing it kind of having rebuilt the Temporal Intelligence Agency.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I guess because it was part of a team, I never considered it could be Creed. I always thought of Steiger as too lone wolf to go join another team.
He is, but when we had him as Sharif Khan or whatever,
yeah,
he had six guys with him.
True.
When he was Barry Martindale, he had a bunch of other people working with him in Dracov. Right.
We also had Bailey in the gun shop.
Mm-hmm.
And Bailey was kind of an interesting character because he purposely revealed himself as a man out of time to other people out of time.
By the design of the knife.
Yeah.
But then when Nielsen mentions, asks some questions mm-hmm. or whatever, trying to probe him out and got no reaction, whatever. And then as he's bought some stuff, because he got some nice, there were one or two things that weren't for sale. And he's like, oh man, I'd love that as a gun collector. It's like, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
And again, built up in previous books, I felt. But then as he's leaving, he's like, is this a so-and-so kind of a gun? And the guy's like, oh, it wouldn't be built for another, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, oh, crap.
Yeah, he managed to spook the guy.
The talking out of turn aspect there
mm-hmm.
Was pretty fun.
Yeah.
And there were aspects of just getting into the gun shop, seeing what life was like back then.
Yes.
Again, it's part of what I love about these novels is it gives you a little bit of a sense of what's it like to be in the then and there.
Yeah. Well, and Nielsen follows Bailey to where he goes,
mm-hmm.
figuring, okay, I spooked him. Maybe he'll lead me somewhere.
Spooked him. He's going to go back to whoever he's going to go back to.
Yeah.
This is when we realize Bailey is underground.
Yeah.
The network has taken his warp disk.
Yeah.
And is just kind of using him. And then they decide, well, he's been burned. His cover's blown. Let's go send him back with somebody else. And when this guy who they don't know is a special operations group or, again, there's so many parties involved.
Yeah, the network has no idea other than, okay, he knew what the gun is. So clearly the Montana kid is not of this time.
But is he special operations group? Is he underground? Is he, what is he?
Yeah.
And it was a don't know, don't care, let's kill him anyways, almost.
Yeah, pretty much.
But this goes back to aspects of the Dracula Caper where Nielsen realizes he's leaving with somebody. They're probably expecting me to follow him.
Yeah.
But I haven't reported in. I've got new information, you know.
Yeah.
He did the responsible thing.
Yeah. Well, and there's a good little internal monologue of these are my options. This is what plays out with each option. I can't take the horse with me with the warp disk.
Well, and there was an aspect of that that reminded me of Lucas early on.
Yes.
I mean, to me, a lot of this was positioning Nielsen to be kind of the equivalent of Lucas at the beginning of the series.
Yeah.
And I would kind of like to see that.
Yeah.
At this point, when I was reading, it was getting late, so I didn't take any more notes till about chapter 7. Quite a bit's happening.
Yeah, the only note I took in chapter 5 was just a hilarious conversation between Andre and Lucas, where, you know, she's telling him to be careful, and he's saying, you know, I wouldn't come back from the dead for just anyone.
Mm-hmm. As if he had a choice in the matter.
Yes, yes. And she's saying, just don't die on me again, or so help me, I'll kill you. Remember, you promised to marry me. And he's saying, you know, that promise was extorted under false pretenses. It was just this great conversation. And I'm like, where was this last book?
I know. That was the part that got me was, this is so in keeping with the, not the last book, but the one prior to that.
Yeah.
With the romance subplot or whatnot. And it was just totally absent.
Yeah.
And in light of this book and the one prior to it, in that middle book, awkwardly so.
Yes.
In the middle of that book, it's like, okay, it's not a big deal. If you'd read only that book, it's like, okay, they're two people, they're coworkers, whatever.
Yeah.
But for that,
Given in the Cleopatra crisis, they went undercover as husband and wife.
Yeah.
To have no banter between them at all, it was noticeable.
No banter, and also specifically when Andre went to meet Cleopatra.
Yeah.
It was a dangerous thing, and all we got is Finn and Lucas agreed to it.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a discussion to be had there.
Yeah, I was just happy to see it back.
I was too, but it also makes me curious about kind of Simon Hawke's writing process. And because as I recall, these last three books may have all come out in the same year.
That's got to be hard.
Totally. And I'm wondering if he was either working on them in parallel, you know, it's like I got an idea over here, but oh, this would work over there, or not. And if he just either got in a time crunch or intentionally dropped the subplot for a little bit. I'd love to get some behind the scenes information on, you know, what was his thought, what led him to these time periods, these decisions, these characters.
Yeah.
But yeah, there was a lot more back and forth between the characters. And the other thing that was as interesting as that was the lack of back and forth between specifically Nielsen and Lucas.
Oh, when they went out on the posse together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, well, in the bar earlier than that and stuff like that, there were a couple of times where Lucas is like, oh, he's not showing any signs of recognition. He's playing it cool. That's smart.
Well, and because we know that he's had the encounter with Bailey, and Nielsen knows that the network or whoever was at that ranch may be on to him, what Lucas is thinking could make sense.
Yep.
And that's why the whole thing plays.
There's an aspect of Lucas is able to rationalize on the posse they're on, Scott not saying anything. He's like, well, you know, this Nielsen is probably afraid somebody's on to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that somebody may be on the posse.
Mm-hmm.
So if he doesn't break cover, I won't break cover. Kind of, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
A kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And of course, Lucas has gone back. His guys is as a reporter. So he's supposed to ask questions.
Yes.
Andre is the wife / secretary.
Which you know she's loving.
I think she's gotten used to it, unfortunately.
I know.
That's why I want to see a story with her having to take the lead, because it's a situation, women's suffrage movement or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just Finn and Lucas couldn't.
Yeah.
You know, kind of promote her a little, if you will, as to de facto team lead or some such. But that whole lack of interaction of why isn't he talking to me in Lucas's point of view.
Yeah.
Up until I think it was chapter 7 where we get a very interesting reveal on that too.
In chapter, I think it may be actually chapter 8. At least chapter 8's where I picked up on it.
7 is Scott wished that Priest and the others would show up.
Yes. Yes.
You know, he couldn't understand what was keeping them.
Yeah.
And mind
you,
at this point, we've seen Lucas having seen Scott.
Yeah.
And
that's when I realized something wonky was going on.
Yeah.
And it's two things that happen in chapter 8.
One more thing in 7. There's a reference of the temporal instability was increasing, and Dracoff wondered how long it would take for the network, the special operations group, and the TIA agents to realize what was going on. And I'm like, I'm wondering how long it'll take me to realize what's going on.
Yes.
Because at this point, it's like, I don't know. I think I'm kind of getting it. Because it was also chapter 7 where Lucas, as the journalist, finally interviews the Montana kid. And the Montana kid's like, who the hell are you? Have we met?
Yeah. Yeah.
And there were a couple of things that were making me think at different points in here that there was a confluence point to be had.
Mm-hmm.
But I still hadn't totally worked out when or where it could be.
Yeah, I was trying to figure it in the middle of the street. And basically, Finn is boarding on the side of the street that's in one time stream. And Lucas and Andre are in the hotel on the other time stream side of the street. What's going on?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, because there are a couple of times they lose track of one another or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was starting to wonder, are there two towns? And then again, how does all of that kind of play out? And that's where it starts to hurt the brain a little bit.
Yes.
Because you know, as of the end of chapter 7 there, Lucas is like, that's not Scott.
Yes. Yes. Well, and he's so funny because he's like, I had to tell the Montana kid there's another Scott Nielsen in London who looks just like him.
What are the odds?
I know, right?
Yeah. Well, and also, I don't think he and Lucas and Andre discussed, could he have been replaced by a hominoid?
No, they did not.
Or counterpart from another Earth. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I wondered if Dracov was replacing people with hominoids. That was one of my curiosities.
Well, because they've already talked to the bartender at length, gotten the story of the observers.
They're dead.
And then when Lucas goes and asks Wyatt Earp about it, he's like, never heard of him.
No such thing happened. Somebody's pulling your leg.
And they're like, how did they get to the whole town?
Yeah, yeah.
There was one thing I highlighted in chapter 8 that kind of caught my attention. And it puzzled me a little, although I started to understand it later. Because, okay, at chapter 7, I'm wondering if it was a confluence point that had matching sides on the two, which we'd not had before.
Yeah.
Chapter 8, though, we get to the point where the Montana kid is getting called out by one of the Claytons, maybe?
Fans. Oh, for the gun draw.
For having shot the guy's brother.
Oh, yes. That was the Deming.
Can't keep all the names straight.
He belongs over in New Mexico. Think that way.
Well, the guy's like, okay, let's do a draw on each other, whatever. And he's like, I don't want to kill anybody. He's like, I got an idea. Okay. You hand one of your guns to that guy, and I'll hand one of my guns to Finn over here. We'll take our other gun we each have, hand it to the bartender. He'll empty them.
Yeah.
And we'll dry fire on each other.
Yeah.
You get the who's faster and you don't got to die kind of thing.
Yeah.
And what got me with that is they did the stuff, handed it to Frank, the bartender. Who opened them up and rotated the cylinders, let the bullets drop out. Five each, he said, after making sure both guns were empty. Okay, five bullets, okay. That makes sense. These are pistols, whatever. This is the six-gun solution. And I was pretty sure that didn't mean somebody had six guns.
I don't know. I kept waiting for someone to have six guns.
I felt it was a shorthand for a six-shooter gun. I'm not really up on firearms.
Neither am I.
But I'm like, they just emptied out five bullets each. Maybe this should have been the five-shooter fix.
Ah, okay.
Could have kept the alliteration. Yeah, you could have solution, fix, I mean, the whole thing. There's actually an explanation a little later.
Yeah.
Well,
chapter 8 is where we find out from the network that there are now bounties on Finn and Lucas and Andre.
Mm-hmm.
And it's where Scott and Finn have a really amazing conversation in which Scott says, nope, we were on different posses in different timelines.
Yeah, the fact that Scott was the one who clued to it first.
Mm-hmm. And what Scott is realizing is because there's a Montana kid who is him in that other timeline, he can't cross over to where he already is.
Everybody who exists, who has a counterpart in the other one, is stuck on their side.
Yeah.
But anyone who's not native to the time period or otherwise doesn't have a doppelganger can bounce between.
Yeah.
And I thought that was fairly interesting.
Yeah.
And it made me start to wonder, though. It's like, okay, the network must be on our Earth's version. Is the special operations group on the other side? Are they over here? It was, even at the end, it was never totally clear who was on which Earth when.
Yeah, exactly. That
and
was
Lucas
my
was
issue.
Very upfront of, I don't know which one we're on now.
Yes, yes. But by this point, they're realizing because there is a Scott Nielsen in each, he's kind of the focal point. And he's probably what Darkness was warning them about.
He also, when he encountered Finn, acted as a bit of an anchor.
Yes.
You know.
Yeah.
But once Scott and Jenny left, Finn suddenly found himself in the other timeline.
Yeah.
And he's like, I didn't feel anything change.
Yeah, which was kind of interesting.
And it goes towards this confluence point, not only is unusual that it matches on both sides.
Yeah.
But it seems to be working differently.
Yeah. Well, and Scott flat out asks Finn, have you thought about the fact that I'm the person you have to kill?
Mm-hmm.
That I have to die here.
And Finn's starting to do the, oh, what are you talking about, kid, kind of a thing. He's like, yeah, don't patronize me.
Yeah.
If you got to do it, you got to do it. I get it.
Yeah. But this is where we get kind of the quality of what kind of guy is Scott.
I thought it was definitely a, I don't say a maturing moment, but definitely a character moment.
Yeah, this is when we find out, okay, who is this guy really? This is the guy who says, make sure you protect the woman I love. Make mm-hmm. sure you take her with you and tell the others if I have to die, it's not just so be it. Tell them I understand. Tell them. Yeah,
it's tell okay.
them, yeah, I get it. I forgive them. Whoever shoots me, I forgive them.
Definitely, this is a character that in the previous books I thought was important to cast well.
Yeah.
Here it is critical.
Yeah.
You've got to have somebody that is eminently likable.
Yeah.
And to me, the way I would have cast this, if I could have caught the actors at the right points, a young Tom Cruise or maybe a young John Barrowman.
Mm.
I'm leaning towards John Barrowman.
Yeah.
If you had him right around the time he was like at Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Early in his career, where he could still kind of pass off as a younger, not that he's old now, but again, you got somebody who can look 17.
Exactly. Yeah.
I think he could have nailed this role.
Yeah.
And having with a, it's okay to kill me. If that saves the timeline, that's...
Exactly.
That's the job.
Yeah.
It was a really, it was a good moment for Scott Nielsen, and this was a great book for him.
Yeah.
And again, we've had him in most of the last couple of books in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah. Well, and Scott Nielsen's the one who brings up the, how did Dracov figure this out?
Yeah.
Because a lot of what Nielsen has pieced together, he's pieced together because of information he got from Jenny, the saloon girl.
Mm-hmm. Knowing that she's only getting bits and pieces from Dracov.
Exactly.
And he's grown quite fond of her and her of him.
Yeah.
And I forget where it was. It was around this point where we realize, true to form, Dracov is, oh, but you're not human, Jenny.
Yeah.
You're artificial. He could never love you.
Yes. He would kill you if he knew.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which, you know, you can trust no one but me, sort of.
Well, and at this point, she's fessed up to him.
She broke her programming because she loved...
Yeah.
Scott.
Yeah.
And he's still thinking, maybe she's playing me kind of a thing. Maybe she broke it. But, I mean, there's an aspect of, you know, there was a line in Chapter 9 of... She'd actually betrayed him for Scott's sake. And I'm like, yeah, that's entirely possible. Yeah. We saw that as far back as when Jason broke his programming in the Argonaut affair.
Exactly. Exactly.
You can condition, you cannot control.
Yeah. Well, but by this point, Dracov, who is a mastermind of manipulation, has begun to understand that.
Yeah. It was interesting because we also got a bit of the history of the hominoids of how they were originally androids. Then he realized, let's go genetic engineering.
Yeah. Which explains kind of the stack of not yet turned on.
Yeah. The androids, I think, we only really saw in the Argonaut affair.
Yeah.
And even limited there.
Yeah.
Well,
poor Delaney has to explain to Lucas and Andre what he and Scott Nielsen have figured out. And then he's trying, as he's explaining it, to say, so you've only been, I guess, in our timeline.
Well, the way they do that is... They've been looking for Finn. Finn's been looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
Finn goes to the hotel he knows they're staying at.
With Scott Nielsen in tow.
With Scott. They're not registered there. Scott and Jenny take off. And then they come down from above.
Lucas and Andre come down the stairs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, but you just weren't registered here.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's just had... I mean, to me, this is something where...
He didn't move
physically.
There's
opportunities... For a director of photography on a film or a TV show on this sort of a thing to really do some both subtle things, be it like a little bit of a rack focus, kind of a almost imperceptible but noticeable wiggle, maybe not, but also just that you've got people coming upstairs followed by people coming downstairs. They should have crossed, but they don't.
Yeah.
But they don't vanish. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, it was really interesting.
So I at this point, I'm trying to, you know, as I was going through, figure out, it's like, okay, I'm pretty sure the entire town is a confluence point of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like the corner of First and Main is the point.
Well, and that's exactly what Delaney works through in his conversation, because he's saying, you know, I don't know if there are specific areas in town where you can cross over and you have to be in the right place at the right time, or if one timeline sort of winks out while the other one blinks in.
Mm-hmm. The timeline shifts out from under you, essentially.
Yeah. And then he says, theoretically, since none of us happen to belong in either time sector, we're getting tossed around like corks on the ocean.
Yeah. Versus the anchored people.
Yeah. That was when I began to understand the whole, okay, so you talk to the bartender, he knows about the dead observers, but then you come back and you actually talked to the duplicate version of... Yeah.
Well, and that's one of those things. If you were to film this, do you play fair with the audience subtly?
Yeah.
Subtle differences in, like, the color of the bow tie. Nothing drastic, nothing, wait a sec.
Yeah, exactly.
But if it's something where it was, like a pinstripe bow tie or whatever, it's straight lines one time but wavy the next, or something to where, it's just a continuity glitch, or I didn't really notice, or how could you not have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know what I think would be the right choice for any of that either.
Well, can't think, was it Awake? The TV show we watched where they use different color filters.
Yeah. I would be hesitant to do anything that is too discernible, because I think there are times where you want to play a little faster and looser on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the being confused about which time stream you were in worked, because it gave us the understanding of what the characters were going through.
Yeah.
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 Well, at this point, they decide to go after Dracov. And so Delaney gets sent back to his rooming house. Well, technically being an abstract term. He clocks over there.
They have the discussion of, do we pull in the whole strike force?
Yes.
And Lucas is like, we've got too much going on. If we send 20 people back here.
Yeah. Well, they also have the discussion, as I recall this, where they have the discussion Andre didn't care for.
Oh, we're going to have to do what Darkness says. Lucas is like, yeah, I trust the guy, even if that means I've got to shoot one of you two. Finn brings that part up.
Yeah, yeah.
Is everybody on board with this? Are we on the same page? We've been told we don't have time for hesitation.
Yeah.
Let's make our peace with it now.
Yeah.
This is where having Darkness as ultimately somebody you feel you can trust, even though he's an arrogant jerk and you don't like him.
Yeah.
Is selling that character throughout the thing builds up to this moment.
Yes. Yeah. 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 So they realize they can't afford to bring a lot of people from their time in, but the head of the Rangers and two or three others makes sense. So Delaney is going to clock back. Finn is going to clock back to his rooming house,
mm-hmm.
and use that tiny little room as the headquarters for that.
Meanwhile, I think the Special Operations Group has decided it's time to take out these intruders.
Well, the Special Operations Group, honestly, was going to kind of leave Finn alone.
It was the network.
The network was watching everybody. And the network was going to kill Delaney, Finn, when he walked into his place, then send somebody to tell Lucas and Andre that Finn was dead, and when they came out, was going to kill them. But the network had sent locals who didn't know about the whole clocking time travel thing. So Finn would have been okay in terms of the guys down on the street who were locals didn't know what's what when he just appears. But Ben Stone, who we haven't really mentioned, who's the SOG head, who Dracov has told the saloon girls to make our guys suspicious of.
Because there is another saloon girl that Finn sleeps with.
Yeah.
And that's... Because at one point, Finn had kind of gone missing after he'd showed up in town.
Yes.
And it turns out he was playing poker, he'd gotten propositioned. It would have looked bad if
Andre was gone. Andre was not happy at all.
No, she was being the responsible one. The mother hen of the group, to a
degree. Yes, she was. Well, the SOG can see four people, you know, going around in Finn's window, and they're like, he called in reinforcements.
Mm-hmm.
He must be after us.
I'm curious what kind of notes Simon Hawk had to keep all of this straight.
Oh, gosh.
Because he does.
Yes. And
it's a little hard to follow, given the way it's doled out, as I would expect in this sort of a book. You know, there's a certain what's going on mystery to be had here that we're solving.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you say he keeps everything straight. Because first, the SOG and their commandos, they take out the locals. Then they go charging the rooming house to take out Delaney and company. Not so good. Okay, so Delaney reached the bottom of the stairs just as Stone and Capilet came through the front door. Downstairs at the back entrance, Georgeson was knocked off his feet as the door exploded inward and SOG commandos came rushing through. Guess who kills him at the back door? Stone! He gasped for breath and fell to his knees as one lung collapsed, then looked up and saw Ben Stone coming through the smoke and flames.
So Stone was two places one time?
Stone was, well, within 2.5 pages. He was at the front door and then at the back door.
I'm going to go with not that big of a building, although I can't rule out two Stones.
You see, that's what got me confused.
There were a couple of times where a lot of names were getting bandied about and the guys were getting taken down pretty quick in rapid succession.
It was Ben.
I did lose track.
It was Ben Stone both times. The question was, did he come in the front door, fight with Delaney, then run back around to the back door? What was going on?
That feels implausible, but yeah.
Yeah, it was very confusing.
I'll admit, around this time, I was kind of tripped up by the fact that so-and-so was being grabbed from behind by black-suited commandos. Like, wait a sec. The SOG wears gray suits.
But they were trying to blend with the shadows.
I know. But that's what was tripping me up.
You know, I really thought that you were going to get caught up by that 1 second of shock. Two guys
clocked by behind, moved up, and slit their throats.
Yes.
Like, yep, back to old school throat slitting.
Yes. Okay, so we had a major fight. Poor Cooper misjudged a distance and broke both his legs.
There was one other thing I want to clarify here is there, Finn's gotten the subset of the strike force back there and they're like, hey, we need more room to work. Let's go set up a safe transition point. Let's use the roof. And you say, oh yeah, I should have thought of that.
Yeah.
But the concern is the stability of the transition point. And for all we know, your people could wind up clocking straight into the dead zone.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, you know what? It's been the first mention of the dead zone in a while.
Yeah.
And that concept goes all the way back to the first book.
Yeah.
We've never really fully explored it. So I propose a possible title for a new book. Should Simon Hawk do this? He's perfectly willing to use it.
Yes.
The Dead Zone Dilemma.
There you go. You know,
no idea what the story would be, but I'm curious what the heck's happened to all these people who went to the Dead Zone.
But see, you know, once we clean up this fight, Delaney clocks dead bodies to the Dead Zone.
With an indeterminate time point. All of this is happening prior to the resolution of the storyline. Post the resolution of this storyline, I'm going to argue you've got the possibility of the Dead Zone having...
Oh, okay. See, because I had been thinking, what if the Dead Zone was a place? Or what if the Dead Zone was actually kind of how people went to the underground? Which is, you know, some people who were thought to go to the Dead Zone had gone to the underground.
Certainly that makes sense. The other thing is... If it is the space between the two timelines, if it were, and this resolves the two timelines, could people have suddenly gotten ejected from the Dead Zone?
Mm. That's an interesting point. Well, now Finn clocks Cooper, or helps Cooper clock, back to plus time for medical attention. And suddenly it's daytime.
There were a few other things I noticed around this time frame, and I'm not sure exactly where they fit relative to that.
It was a very busy time frame.
The least little thing is liable to trigger off a time wave.
Yes, that was...
Like, what the hell's a time wave?
Well, they've kind of alluded to it throughout the book and coming up to this, but it was this sense that changes ripple. And, well, Scott Nielsen at one point...
He realized he'd lost a week.
Yeah.
Skipping time to the... And it's like you've suddenly just been bumped forward.
Yeah.
Nobody seemed to have missed him during that week.
Yeah. Well, and it's about the time of the fight that Lucas and Andre come out of the hotel. They're getting shot at from the rooftop. Andre happened to trip on those awkward high heels, which I don't blame her at all, but that saved her.
And so, it's believable for her to trip on high heels.
Exactly, exactly. So they go running in the street to try and dodge the bullets, and suddenly they go from night to daytime.
Well, and we get the other side of that if they just vanished.
Yes.
Again, this is another opportunity for a director of photography to do just some really cool stuff. Mm-hmm. Of seeing that scene play out from the two angles.
Yeah.
Of you've got the overhead shot of the guy on the top of the building across the street shooting at them, and then run, where did they go? Followed by, again, or preceded by, depending on, you know, they're running in how to do this well. They're running down the street, and then suddenly, bam, it's daytime.
Yeah.
And if you could do that night-to-day kind of a shot, to me, that's almost a soundstage sort of a deal.
Yeah.
But if you can do it and you can sell it, it's like that would go towards the, okay, there was a time skip.
Yeah. Well, and that seems to be this time wave thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The other thing we got was, I guess it was Jenny heading to the gun store to go do some stuff. And she picks up one of the cabinets, opens up one of the cabinets, pulls out a box of ammo, and quickly loads all six chambers.
Yes.
Finally, a six shooter.
Yeah.
Because I hadn't realized they were all six shooters up until then. They just had five bullets.
Yeah, well, you know. But they explained that usually you kept one empty.
That I picked up in the afterward.
That's where that was. Okay. I was going to say it was somewhere in all of this.
They may have had it earlier.
Yeah.
But the basic thing, and there's a lot in the afterward about guns, which was helpful.
Yes.
But also some in previous books too. But apparently, you would have a six shooter and you would have five chambers loaded, one left empty, which is kind of what's in the ready position, to where if the hammer got jolted, it wouldn't set the gun off.
Yeah.
Which is why when one of the, I forget who it was in this two, may have been in the afterword, going out and stuff, it's like, oh, he meant business because he had all six chambers filled.
Yes.
It's like, well, then you're ready to shoot somebody.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, I don't say it was the equivalent of the safety, but it kind of sort of was.
Yeah.
So there was some aspects there where it's like, okay, she's going to cause some trouble.
Yes.
And again, at this point, we're thinking it's all...
Wyatt Earp had gone to arrest Scott. And that's she right. got the gun to pull on Wyatt to make him release Scott. And at first, Scott's saying, look, just let this play out. And she says, you don't understand. Finn's in trouble. I heard gunshots at the boarding house.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Scott's like, sorry, Wyatt. You gotta let her have her way.
Yeah, as he's taking his jacket off and getting ready to put the holster on. Type.
Yeah.
And Wyatt, to his credit, it's like, okay.
You'll regret this. He's
got a gun pulled on him.
Yeah, exactly.
And this comes down to casting the right people for Doc Holliday, mm-hmm. Wyatt, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's almost got to feel like this is who you would have cast if it had simply been the shootout of the OK Corral movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And these other people just happen to have taken over the lot and the story.
Yeah.
And yeah, this is where Delaney clocked Stone's body to non-specific time. I don't know how you set the warp disk for that. I don't know why you would set the warp disk for that.
I decided that was the equivalent of the incinerator.
Well, is it? Because they've got fugue sequences they've used.
Mm-hmm.
If you could program multiple hops, which obviously you can,
mm-hmm.
and you then program it to, okay, let's kick this into the dead zone for a little bit and then pop it somewhere else.
Mm.
Why would you do that versus just send it straight to the somewhere else? I don't know.
Yeah. No, I think once you're in the dead zone, you're that whole dead concept.
I don't know. Well, for a person, but maybe not for an inanimate object.
Mm.
I.e. is it a storage place if you're clever?
I guess we haven't heard of anything coming out of the dead zone. That's all I'm saying.
Why I think there's another book to be written.
Okay, I agree.
One of many.
Yeah.
Because I came out of that and I still want to know more about the dead zone.
I agree.
This one, not the Stephen King one. But we also get a bit here about how, kind of what Dracoff's plan is. Because the whole time it's like, okay, maybe the network is here to get some of the silver that they're robbing from the stagecoaches, whatever. Send it to a time they can profit on.
Yeah.
Sure, that works.
Yeah.
Still not entirely sure what the Special Operations Group was doing here. Never quite clear on their agenda.
No.
But Dracoff is clearly setting stuff up, getting everything lined up for what? And it turns out that his plan was basically by taking a particular shot at the right time, at the right place, the future would cease to be. Just one shot, its report masked by the gunfire that would be shortly erupted in what was no more than an insignificant blood feud, everything would change. Universes would shift, setting off a time wave that would travel down the time stream, building an intensity, altering events, and the course of those events would be altered. Moses Forrester would never have been born. He would never live to meet and fall in love with a Russian gypsy girl named Vanna Dracova. She would be spared the torment she had suffered, and he, Nikolai Dracoff, would never have lived. Sweet oblivion awaited him. And I'm like, you know, there's got to be simpler ways to commit suicide than wiping out all of time and space.
Yes. Yes.
But I'm like, how could Dracoff have known this?
They do get to that.
They do. They cover it a couple of different ways. Because we learn in the conclusion that, I guess it was Earp, Wyatt Earp, was Moses' great-great-great-great-great-some-odd grandfather. Mm-hmm. But we also learn, and I forget exactly how they figured this part out, but that Dracoff had done what they would consider unthinkable. Mm-hmm. He went forward in time.
Yeah.
He read up on this stuff.
Yeah.
He said, oh, I can do this.
Yeah.
So he was working with advanced knowledge, not as advanced as darkness.
Yes.
And darkness's whole plot line seemed to be, let's take care of Dracoff.
Well, and we haven't covered what darkness ended up telling them to do. Who had to shoot who?
Well, it was interesting because Darkness takes a fairly direct hand in some of this. He just, in his state, wasn't sure he could be in two places at once. Mm-hmm. So he basically, as Finn's realizing that Scott and, I guess, Wyatt were in a position or whatever, and that Jenny was going to distract Scott, he's like, well, this is going to do whatever happens. I got to kill Scott.
Well, he thought that Scott and Jenny were both running in, and he didn't know Jenny was going to scream out. Mm-hmm. But he knew Scott was running in, and he thought Scott was going to distract Wyatt and get Wyatt killed because Wyatt thought Scott was a bad element.
So Finn's ready to shoot Scott, and Darkness is like, shoot the girl.
Yeah.
He's like, okay. Mm-hmm. And with a disruptor, I think.
Yes.
Now,
Lucas and Andre, when they had been running down the street, had gotten forwarded in time, but they'd also gotten thrown into the other universe with the real Montana Kid.
This is another one where the director of photography would have a very interesting challenge.
Yeah.
Because they get to where they're like stuck in molasses. Time is slowed down. Time is wonky at this point.
Well, and what's interesting is you've got Wyatt Earp, Virgil Earp, Doc Holliday, and the Montana Kid walking up to meet the Clantons, etc. So instead of Scott running in from the side, you've got him with the Earps. And in what they see, Jenny runs in, because in that other time stream, there is a real Jenny. Mm-hmm. She runs in. She screams out to Scott because she's afraid he's going to die. She distracts both him and Wyatt, and they get killed in the gunfight at the OK Corral.
And at about that point, as they've seen the stuff play out, time kind of kicks back in. They've shunted to the other universe.
Yeah.
And they're starting to see them start to play out.
Yeah.
So there's a definite...
Well, and what Darkness explains is that the two time streams were coming so close together and almost matching because Dracoff had forced
the same people. He had engineered the differences away.
Yeah.
Let's get Jenny here. Scott happens to show up. That seemed to be a little more dumb luck than...
But he knew Scott was a sharpshooter.
Seemed like an obvious pick.
Yeah.
But there's an aspect of Dracoff's plan that still seemed to rely on luck. Not having a Scott waiting, a Montana Kid waiting in the wings.
I agree.
But by basically setting up the situations to where for one moment in time, they would, at a particular, a chaotic of temporal integrity moment in time, they would exactly match. It's he was trying to force a reverse split, if you will, a merging of the timelines.
Yes, yes. And that's something we've seen as far back as the Scarlet Pimpernel.
Was it the Scarlet Pimpernel, or was it...
It was the Scarlet Pimpernel, where at the end, in the tavern, I guess, on the French side.
Okay, subtle difference. That was one where there was a divergence,
yes.
Split, and it unsplit. It
right.
Merged.
It merged.
This is taking two separate timelines.
Well, I agree, but it's the same effect of merging, which was you were going to wipe out one whole timeline.
Right. I guess to me the difference is whether they had branched to begin with or whether they had started out separate.
I agree.
It seems harder to collapse two into one that were meant to be different.
Yes, I agree.
And the plot of one of the other books, I forget which it was I thought this sort of attempted reverse split, the merging of some of the two timelines. I'd have to go back. At one point I was making the notes as to this is an adjustment of an adjustment sort of a thing. And I thought one of the first five or six books had that, but I don't remember which.
A million words later, I'm
I know,
stumped.
It's... But this was a fairly intricate plan. Mm-hmm.
Well, and Dracov wanted to shoot Fenn also, just for a little icing on the cake.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And when Lucas and Andre ran in, they ended up getting thrown to the ground. And when they shift time streams back into ours, and Andre starts to get up, Lucas realizes what's going on and realizes they're in the crossfire. And so he makes Andre stay down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that one of us is supposed to shoot. It's Fenn who's got the weapon and is supposed to fire, and we're supposed to stay down.
There was a lot, I think he was, I don't want to say taking on faith.
Yes.
But this is one where having a clear lay of the land from the building up to this, you know, having a couple of shots in a movie where it's almost taken like by a drone and you could see the whole town and,
yeah.
Okay, we get to this. We're now intimately familiar with this intersection, this part. Oh, wait, they're where? Oh, crap, you know.
Yeah.
If it's clearly shot, you could tell what is going on. If it's not, if it's all close-ups, cut.
Yes.
Why are they staying down? You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
And that's one of those things where, with a book, the author has the opportunity to clarify, but with a movie, you have the opportunity to observe.
Yes.
And both can work well, both can work poorly, depending on the execution.
Yeah.
And there was just a lot going on here and a lot of having to, oh, now I see how everything's piecing together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are the people we've met. These are the ones we haven't quite. They've bounced between. Okay, now we're merging. Oh, wait. Dracov is doing this. Why is he taking the shot? Oh, he's trying to collapse everything down. I think I get it. Kind of a deal.
Yeah. Well, he's going to collapse the two time streams and guarantee his family line never happens.
I guess my question is, darkness kind of bops him on the head, Dracov on the head, so they can capture mm-hmm. him, take him forward, fix him, which he needed. Why couldn't darkness have arranged for Jenny to have been clocked forward? If at the gun store?
Yeah.
Scott's like, you gotta trust me, we gotta go.
I think, given all Darkness claims to know, I think there's also a Darkness didn't want Scott marrying a humanoid Jenny for some reason. A person who couldn't have children.
It just seemed like Scott Nielsen didn't get a happy ending.
Oh no, definitely. And the only reason I could come up with that was Darkness thought that Nielsen was supposed to have a family line.
I'm also wondering if Simon Hawke was expecting maybe a few more books and was realizing, no, got to wrap it up. Because one of Scott's last thoughts in the book is there's not enough time.
Yes. Yeah.
Or there wasn't enough time.
Yeah. Well, and I thought that was just one of their many jokes about time. I mean, they wrapped up Forrester. He's retiring. And he whether he meant to or not, he practically has grandchildren as well as a son. Because they've gotten from Dracov where all the clones were and retrieved them. They've dealt with the hominoids. Lucas has been promoted, not only in rank, but to the
director, because Moses is retiring.
Yeah.
And these guys had all been promoted at the beginning of the book, too.
Yeah.
And at that point, I'm thinking, well, that's the highest Finn's ever been. Now he's even higher.
Yeah.
Right, this is pretty much the ultimate promotion for Lucas. And it sets, to me, another round of books potential. With Lucas in charge.
Yeah.
Finn is the guy who's got to rout out the corruption or whatnot. And Andre is kind of the right-hand person or whatever.
Yeah.
It was... I thought it resolved that, okay, the two timelines have now been bounced far enough apart. That's not an issue.
Yeah.
Time war is resolved, provided they don't go throwing off any more warp grenades.
Well, yes and no, because it's resolved in terms of it's not a danger, but we don't have peace.
Fair enough, but we don't have the ability, well.
We don't have danger, but we don't have peace.
In theory, the other side is continuing to monitor for confluence points that they won't find.
True.
And it comes down to, does darkness on our side or their side say, I wonder if I could travel dimensions.
Yeah.
You know, I've gone up and down a timeline. Can I go across, you know?
Yeah.
Could something restart?
Yeah.
Because if we were to believe darkness, and there's no reason not to, the future has been salvaged.
Yeah.
The other timeline's not a threat. So the whole need for the observers and all of this, they could go back to the Time Wars if they wanted to. Hopefully they're smarter than that.
Yeah.
But it's not like, well, we're disbanding everything, everybody go retire. We promoted Lucas.
Well, and we've still got the network in play.
Still got the network in play. And I think they got all the special operations people. There's nothing to say that there wasn't somebody else who'd gotten onto the wrong timeline.
Yeah.
And to me, they wound down the stories that were in play for the most part.
Yeah.
I don't think entirely. I still feel that Steiger's alive.
Yeah.
The network hasn't been eradicated, etc. But I guess my question would be, if Simon Hawke were to come back to this, and I hope he would, what would be the thing that kicks off that next round of stories?
Space, the final frontier.
It's Time Wars, not Space Wars.
No, the reason I mention that, though, is because the warp grenades were toasting space colonies. So basically, we learned enough from the other time stream that it's a, why aren't we doing these things?
Things I would like to see touched on, because we're now not in the late 80s, early 90s. Mm-hmm. At that point, the space race, we were still having the shuttle missions. We were in a good place there. Now, not so much.
Yeah.
So there's story to play with there. I think the social media, media in general, political realm has a lot of potential.
Yeah.
For both social commentary and how could so-and-so get into this sort of a position, you know, oh, well, you know, they were engineered, whatever. The potential for the network to do a temporal election manipulation is rife. Well,
there's even as simple as you don't need to send someone back to assassinate a president to change our political lives. It would seemingly be simpler to send somebody back to kill Lee Harvey Oswald.
Or be an influential teacher.
Yes.
I mean, imagine if you had a plot that was so almost subtle and sublime that it takes a few books for somebody to realize what's going on.
Yeah.
And then it's something to where it's like, we know X shouldn't have happened, but there's no clear single cause. But if you take almost Dracoff's mindset of engineering a life for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And you almost, I don't want to say do a Truman Show kind of a thing where everything is staged around them.
Yeah.
But if there's just enough and you had enough hit and run kind of almost, if you will, interaction with somebody to just nudge them a little, you know, to get somebody in or out of politics or not to be a scientist or whatever. That I think would be fun.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a lot of story potential that hasn't been dealt with. Again, we talked about be fun to see stuff in Shakespeare's time.
Yes.
Be fun to see a position where Andre's got to be a little more involved in lead a mission.
Yeah.
Certainly I would have Scott Nielsen be one of the feature characters.
Yeah.
I want to see a little bit more played in this universe. I want to see what's going on with the Dead Zone. And just, does life quiet down for these people? Does it not? Does it seem to, you know, what happens next?
Yeah, I agree.
It's a fun universe and a lot of potential. The other thing is the afterword on this.
Very long. Very good, but very long.
Very informative.
Yeah.
And kind of what I wish he would have done for almost all of the books. I'm a process junkie. And when he said early on that he was an avid shooter and reloader, I'm like, okay, I'm not entirely sure exactly what that means. But it explained a lot, particularly about the Nielsen character.
Yes.
because there was the lengthy gun debate and gun control debate and stuff in Dracula Caper and whatnot, or no, Hellfire.
Hellfire.
But it's like, okay, this guy is, Simon Hawke is clearly very knowledgeable about this.
Mm-hmm.
Seems to understand the weapons and whatnot. And this is where we started to get the standard practice was to load FUD, carry it with a hammer on the empty chamber. Oh, okay, now I get that. But we also got just a ton of information about the shootout at the OK Corral, and he's citing like three maybe different recountings of it. One that was pro Wyatt, one was anti Wyatt or Earps, and
yeah,
one that was kind of in the middle. He's like, this one's well done. You look at the newspapers at the time, one was clearly on this side, one was clearly on that side. And he's kind of almost doing the mystery investigation to figure out what had kind of happened there.
Yeah.
And he was very clear. Yeah, I'm skipping a few things. I'm compressing events. Like he talked about in the Khyber Pass with Churchill.
Yes.
Played a little fast and loose. That's fine.
Yeah.
But having these sorts of explanation and insights afterwards...
Yeah.
Allows somebody to say, I'm curious about this. I want to learn more. Oh, I should go here. Great. You know, gives them a starting point.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because he says that two of the considered to be, you know, most important books about the Earps were based, one was based on interviews with Virgil's widow and the other was based on interviews with Josie, Wyatt's widow. And then he says, of course, both of those didn't get published until after both those women were dead.
Yes. And I think in one case, an editor fixed what he thought was embellishments or
yes.
You know, there was one, were they truthful to begin with? And two, were they published as written?
Yes. Yes.
And I think there's a lot that could be said. And I'd love for them to do Simon Hawke to do a book on the winner writes the tale.
Yes.
And imagine if somebody were to have to do an adjustment during a time period at which what has been reported on is just so wrong.
Yeah.
Through incompetence, through manipulation, through whatever.
Yeah.
And what if you have two observers come back with very different accountings?
Yeah.
You know, if you had sent two observers to Tombstone, you could have gotten two. Well, the Wyoming or the Montana kid was there.
Yes.
You know, no, he wasn't. Ed, who do you believe? Who do you not believe? How do you resolve all of that? But it was, I was surprised by the length of the afterword because normally it's a page or two.
Yeah.
And this went on a good couple of pages on the guns, on, again, the history of the shooter of the OK Corral. Who do you go with? Who do you don't? I don't, you know, and the author's like, I don't buy this because this just doesn't make sense.
Yes.
Guns, you're in a gunfight, bullets have been fired. Why would you turn your back on the people in front of you shooting at you?
Yes.
Or this guy, you know, seems a little crooked for these reasons. Kind of Occam's razor, the simplest solution or whatever. Go with that.
Yeah.
With a, who knows what exactly happened.
Yeah.
But it certainly, in my mind, clarified a couple of aspects of some of the books as to the author's perspective on things.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed how, again, with the Hellfire stuff, there was a lengthy debate about the guns, pro and con and all of that.
Yeah.
Where I didn't come out of it feeling, well, clearly this guy is really far on this side of the fence or something.
Yeah.
I think Simon Hawke does a good job of writing fairly even-handedly.
Yeah.
And that's important given how many factions are at play in many of these books.
Yeah.
Because he doesn't come down, like in the Hellfire Rebellion, pro-revolution, anti-revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Or Caesar, pro-death, you know, let's not kill Caesar, or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Or in the Argonaut Affair, pro-mythology, anti-mythology, you know, he gives a even recounting and, it plays out such that in most of these cases, and this was a great example, well, it could be A, it could be B that's happening. I don't know which. We need more information.
Yeah.
And kind of keeps you on the fence while playing fair, withholding information.
Yes.
And I guess these stories are a great example of why I hate spoilers.
Yes.
Because if you know going in, well, the whole town's a confluence point.
Yeah.
Well, then you're not really puzzled by why does Scott not react to Lucas? Why has he been in a posse with Lucas but thinking Lucas hasn't shown up?
Yes. Yes.
Seeing a story how it is unfolding at the author's control, the creator's control, versus getting snapshots of it told almost out of sequence with explanation and, you know, in a very different manner than the author intended.
Yeah.
It's not fair to the author of the story.
Yeah. No, I agree with that.
I mean, if I had come into this book telling you before you'd read it, oh man, this one is just so overly convoluted. It's way complicated or it's really a pedestrian plot line. It was so transparent or something. Either way.
Yeah.
Would have set expectations and then would have moved the needle for you in one direction or another.
Yeah.
Either in the direction I was saying or maybe against it, depending. Mm-hmm. But again, I've enjoyed rereading all of these, being at a different point in my life than when I had originally read them, having been to different parts of the world from when I had originally read them and such. Definitely would like to see him do more.
Me too.
He's done 3 or 4 other series. Psychodrome lasted 2 novels. There was the Inadequate Adept that lasted a couple of books, and the Wizard of 4th Street series that lasted, I'm going to say, 7 or 8 books. Was pretty good. That one, Dark Horse, turned the first book into the start of a miniseries. I think it made it 2 issues, maybe. That was 86 or whatever. It's interesting because in one of the books, I forget which one, in, was it the afterword? At some point, he was thanking various people. Mm-hmm. And he actually mentions Mile High Comics.
Oh, interesting.
As one of the places that maybe he'd been to either their store or a convention in the area or whatever.
Nice.
But Chuck Rosansky specifically, I think, was mentioned.
Nice.
So, and I knew he, Simon Hawk had a connection to comics in so much as he had at least worked a little bit with Dark Horse as that series started. It never finished, which was annoying. But this is a series that I definitely think would be fun to translate into comics, TV, or movie. Mm-hmm. But there again, some passages like when we get, this is who Dracoff is, here's his backstory. It's a lengthy kind of digression as we're waiting for Forrester to say, well, what do we do about him or whatever?
Yeah.
And I'm like, how do you have that play out in a movie?
Yeah.
And I go back to a comment I made a couple of books back or whatever, where I would almost do it as if the audience is somehow almost an invisible observer with an implant with subknowledge. Mm-hmm. So at certain points, things would pop up and give you, you know, the description or whatever, and slow time down enough for you to read that, or it would read it to you or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Giving you, again, kind of the vantage point some of the characters have at various points with that. Because if you don't know who Dracoff is, if you don't remember certain events or whatever,
yeah,
it doesn't play as well.
Yeah.
And I would certainly want these to be, if they were 12, you know, movies, they'd almost be long movies, but movies, miniseries, whatever, have enough clear callbacks like the books do, mm-hmm, that you get the building story, that you could come in at different places.
Yes.
Because if you look at, like, the Harry Potter movies, if you come in at, like, the 5th movie, I think you might be a little lost.
Yeah.
Here, even if you came in on this last novel,
yeah,
Nielsen's fully introduced. You get a sense of what's going on between a lot of the characters. You know who Dracoff is. You know his relation to Forrester. Get a sense about darkness. You don't get everything.
No, but you get enough.
You get enough to follow through, even on some of the things like the relationship between Lucas and Andre.
Yeah.
You kind of get the joke.
Yeah.
Of she's not joking. He's not ready.
Yes.
You know, you could have started with that book and moved forward at that point.
Yeah.
And to me, that's the sign of a really good writer, is somebody who is keeping stories accessible, open to new readers, and not, well, this is the 12th book of a series. If they don't know by now.
Yes.
You know, there's nothing I can do to tell them or whatever. It's like, oh, at least give it the effort. And in this case, I felt every book he did a great job on that.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, reading them in fairly rapid succession like we did, because while these episodes are getting doled out over time, we've recorded them in the span of
9 weeks.
I was going to say 10, but 9 sounds about right. So faster than a book a week. There are a few places where it was hard for me to remember this phrasing of thus and so. Did I read that earlier in this book, or was that a previous book? Yeah. You know, because there are certain, you know, the description of Dracoff's scar or
His Byronic features.
His Byronic features, or how the network came to be, or why Forrester's a marked man, or,
yeah,
you know, Andre's backstories, having posed as a knight. And,
mm-hmm. Lucas belongs on recruitment posters.
Yeah. Finn's not a recruitment poster. He's a slob. Yes. But there's a consistency to it, almost a little too much in rapid succession. I go back to the Claremont era of the X-Men.
Yeah.
You know?
Well,
and it was not to the point of, geez, he's doing this again.
No, but it was kind of funny with the whole Finn has the record for demotions.
And the most promotions or whatever.
Yes, yes. Well, you can only get promoted to a certain rank. So in order to get the record for promotions, I guess you have to have the record for demotions.
I would have liked a comment somewhere along the lines of Finn almost self-deprecatingly saying, I've been promoted 1,000 times.
Yes.
You're exaggerating. No, he's not. There aren't that many ranks. I know. He's also been demoted 1,000 times.
Oh, right.
Is it a sense of humor to be had there?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's also part of the fun of this, is there's that sense of the familiar and the comfortable among the leads.
Yes. Yeah.
That they can have that banter that they had in this book of, you heard him propose. It's like, yep, I did.
Yes.
You know, that would be hard to have play authentically.
Yeah.
Even in many of the shows and stuff we've watched.
Yeah.
That kind of banter would have felt out of place even in, say, the final season of Next Generation or something.
Yeah.
That just wasn't the relation those characters had.
Yeah.
It was a bit different. Whereas here, they've spent enough time together, they've problem solved enough together.
Yeah.
And the fact that in most of these books, are just trying to figure out what the hell is going on. Mm-hmm. As the reader is trying to figure out what the hell is going
on. Yeah.
I think helps in the immersion into the story. So I've, again, really enjoyed these. I thought they were fun to reread. I'm glad you seem to enjoy them.
I did. I enjoyed them a lot.
Again, I'm a big fan of time travel and things that give me just something to kind of ponder about.
Yeah.
I am hoping that Simon Hawke will get to a point where he gets back into writing. It seemed that I don't say life got in the way, but you know, hey, he's gotta do what's right for him.
Yeah.
And I think he's one of far too many writers that made some money at it, but not a living at it, not enough of a living at it.
Yeah.
But I also think where things were at in late 80s, early 90s versus where things are at now in terms of, I think there's life these 12 books could have in movie, in TV, in comics.
Definitely.
Even in video games.
Or a short run, short number of episode series on Netflix.
Absolutely. There's a lot I think this material as is could be leveraged for and should be.
Yeah, I agree.
He's done a great job on it, and I'd like to see live action versions of this. But I'd also like to see more books.
Yes.
So here's hoping to that. Hopefully the listeners have enjoyed hearing what we've had to say on all of these. We've got a few other books that we've talked about doing episodes on. Don't know when or if that will be. We've still got to discuss that. I will say that carving out, because each of these books took 4 or 5 hours to read easily.
Yeah.
And we just did 12 of them in the last 9 or 10 weeks. That was a pretty sizable time commitment, plus the hour or so to record, and then there's the editing and all of that stuff. So certainly if we do more books, which I'd like to, doing them at a saner pace would probably be helpful for both of us.
We'll see.
The advantage to doing it in rapid succession with this kind of a series is it's easier to remember the previous ones. But
yes,
this is literally like a million words all said and done for this series.
Yeah.
But it's a great read. I think Simon Hawke should be proud of the work he did. I'm glad he's gotten them back into print, onto Kindle and other ebook formats. Mm-hmm. And I want to see him write some more. He's a great writer.
I agree.
So anything else? We're good.
I think that does it.
Cool.
The show notes and form for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.